Chapter 81. Tia only pretended to flee. As soon as Andros Gael kicked her out to talk to Kip, she walked hurriedly past the blackguards standing watch and headed down the hall and out of sight. She summoned the lift but didn't get on. Instead, she pulled out the hood of her cloak. She looked left and right, saw no one, and willed herself to become invisible. Nothing. She felt up in the neckline and found the choker, a narrow band of metal that was attached to the cloak at many points. She pulled it up against her neck. She trembled, a shudder of revulsion coursing through her. No one collared their slaves on the Jaspers. It was considered gauche. Beatings and other discipline were to be carried out at home, not in public. To need to discipline one's slave in public reflected poorly on your own mastery. Slaves, of course, knew that any public defiance, however satisfying, would be met with double punishment later. Other cities and other men were not so civilized, or perhaps not so hypocritical. This wasn't the first time Tia had worn a collar, but it was the first time she'd done so voluntarily. The feeling of constriction around her neck was almost unbearable. Things to do, T. Not much time, T. Could come out any second. Still have to figure out how to use the damned thing. She moved the loose necklace that held the little vial of oil aside. Her hands held the choker's clasp loosely, unmoving. She was breathing deeply, almost hyperventilating, and not clasping the damned clasp. Chains. I've done everything in my life to get away from chains. Part of her argued with that. Some garbage about differences between slavery and a cloak that empowered her. It didn't change the visceral revulsion. These are the chains I choose. The chains I choose. She cinched the choker tight and extended her will. Teeth shot out of the choker and sank into either side of her neck. They hurt so bad she doubled over and almost screamed. And then her breath was taken for another reason. She could feel it. The cloak had a presence within it. It wasn't a whole personality. Instead, if the chirurgeons were correct and cogitation took place in the human brain, it was as if the cloak had all the parts of a person's brain that dealt with light splitting and magic sunk into it, with a whisper of personality there. To make this cloak, someone had given her life, or had it taken from her. The cloak knew how to split light in the ways that Tia had barely glimpsed when she broke into the White's office. In all her life, Tia had had to struggle for every excellence. She could sing, but had seen other slaves remember every note in a tune in one or two hearings. She could fight, but she'd seen other blackguards combine throws and punches and kicks into series as fluidly as if fighting were a language and they were constructing elaborate arguments. Her own style was terse, fast, but ultimately simple, without nuance. She could look at Cruxer or Winston and see that they were already maturing into the best in the world, their skills growing by leaps and bounds. That was beyond her, and always would be. Her speed would get no better. Her reach was terminally short. In a continuum that began with Big Leo and Kip and Iron Fist, she was not strong. Her aim would improve, as would her knowledge of where and when to strike. Among the best, she would become mediocre, every scrap of her skill earned only by the most challenging labour. Nor had she any excellence in her studies. Despite his difficulty reading, Ben-Hadad could extemporize, looking at the gears and pulleys and weights and strengths of each Luxin and designing machines as if it were play to him. Kip could memorize and make great intuitive leaps. If study were scrivening, they wrote in a perfect hand and illuminated their manuscripts for fun while the dullards caught up to them. By contrast, Tia held the quill in her fist. At the touch of whatever will was animating the cloak, Tia knew two things immediately. First, light splitting at the level of the old Mistwalkers was as difficult as any magical or mundane skill in the world. It was as difficult as juggling and sprinting and singing at once, blindfolded. Second, more importantly, it made sense to her. Simply using this cloak would teach her more than any master could. She already saw how this cloak was superior to the other. None of the cloaks, not even this one, split light beyond the visible spectrum. Sub-red was too long a wave to be diverted and reformed within the thin layer of fabric, and superviolet was too fine. Even among light splitters, the only people who had a chance to be fully invisible to all spectra would be peril drafters. A true mist walker might use a shimmer cloak to handle visible light, while using a parol mist to handle the last two spectra herself. And then it was obvious. They were called mist walkers, not because they were invisible or could only be seen as though through a mist, but because they walked within their own cloud of parol. Always. And this cloak would teach her how to do it. Without ever expecting such a thing, Tia had found her purpose and her excellence. It was quite possible that no one in the world understood this like she did. For the first time in her life, she didn't feel inferior. She would have started crying if she hadn't heard the door open around the corner down the hall, and Andros Gyle grunt something to his blackguards. Drafting even a thread of parol was enough to activate the cloak. Tia threw the hood up and reached to lace it up over her face, but there were no laces. She fumbled, looking for some kind of fasteners, and when she drew the edges close, they snapped shut firmly, as if lodestones were sewn into them. Much faster than the other shimmer cloaks. Even with this cloak, though, she couldn't cover her eyes completely unless she wanted to be blind. No light, no sight. It might be worth covering them in certain situations, but it would also be terrifying. Instead, she would have to rely on taking quick, sidelong glances or creeping around at low levels where enemies wouldn't be looking for eyes. Being short helped the latter, of course, but she was going to have to take care that she not get overconfident. The approach of Andros and his guards presented an instant problem. How much did she trust the cloak, really? She took deep breaths as the three men approached and stood off to the side, sneaking only quick glances at them to keep her eyes hidden. They passed right by her. A thrill went through her body from head to toe. Invisible. Andros turned to his blackguards as they waited for the lift and said,
"I'll be heading to my home, immediately. Summon a squad of light guards to accompany us."
Of course, they were insulted by that, and of course they said nothing, taking it like the professionals they were, but what Tia thought was odd was that she couldn't remember Andros Gyle ever going to his home on Big Jasper. Why would he be headed to his home now? The lift appeared before Tia heard any response, if there was any. Andros Gyle was going to his home on Big Jasper on the very day that his lost grandson showed up at the docks. From how Samite told it, it sounded like the boy was announcing who he was to anyone who would listen. Tia couldn't imagine Andros Gyle going home if the boy was headed to the Chromeria. Andros Gyle would go to where the centre of action was, or have the action brought to him. Which meant Andros Gyle was having the boy taken to his home, to meet him away from spying eyes. Well, other than Tia's. She suddenly grinned. She leaned out into the lift shaft to see where it stopped. Ground floor. After waiting half a minute, she stepped onto another ring of the lift mechanism and set the weights. She descended slowly. At the ground floor, she had to dodge several old Luxiats piling into the lift, but they moved slowly and she made it out with little trouble before they could observe that the weight settings of the lift seemed off. She searched for Andros Gyle then and couldn't see him anywhere. She went to the great open door, soon to be shut for the evening, and spotted him through a swirl of white and black cloaks. He was heading out of the Chromeria. She followed. There was something totally empowering, even intoxicating, about walking unseen. Here were the drafters of the world, the cream of the seven satrapies, and they couldn't even see her. No wonder the Order's assassins loved these cloaks, even without using them to their full potential. This was amazing. It was also surprisingly challenging. Tia was used to ducking and dodging through a crowd, but it was one thing to brush past someone who barely saw you, and something altogether different to actually get run over by someone who didn't see you at all. That, and the fact that the shimmer cloak completely cut out her peripheral vision, made simply moving at a walk almost exhausting. She was constantly turning her head, sneaking glimpses of everything, adjusting the parol bubble as the evening crowds head back across the bridge from Little Jasper to their homes on Big Jasper. She was lucky that Andros Gyle hadn't chosen to ride. As a colour, much less as Promarchos, it was his prerogative. He'd chosen instead to walk, which she hoped meant that he wasn't going far. She should know where his home was, but the truth was, she'd spent all her time in the wrong neighbourhoods. Still, it was an odd thing for a man who just a year ago had seemed practically an invalid. That he walked also meant that he'd picked up four more black guards, and an equal number of light guards. Six black guards might seem overkill, but it was a time of war, and Andros was the Promarchos. Tia barely counted the light guards, other than to note their presence. Pretenders. Once they were in the open streets, following was much easier. They didn't go far, either, and soon Tyr saw the Guile estate. Its dome was, of course, gold. The great doors were black oak, studded with garnets. The great crossbeams were black oak over forever-burning Atasifusta wood, which had been set alight to announce that Lord Guile was in residence. The garnets picked up the red glow and reflected it beautifully in the fading sunlight. The Guile estate was so large it was home not only to one of the tallest of the thousand stars, it also had a small yard and garden, enormous luxuries on the overcrowded island. Sentry boxes stood on either side of a thick, tall gate, sheathed in iron. Some estates had simple wrought iron gates, presumably, Tyr thought, to let pedestrians see through them to show off their owner's wealth. But open iron gates were a terrible idea for a city full of drafters. Stick your hands through the gaps and draft freely. The Guiles valued their privacy or their defence more. And here's where it gets sticky. Suddenly Tyr had to ask herself just how much she wanted to follow Andros Guile. He might well simply go into his home and go to bed. All she had was wild guesses and intuitions. She could be risking her life for simple curiosity. The Guile guards opened the gates for them. Two of the black guards slipped inside, weapons drawn, while two kept an eye on the guards. Despite that the men were older and must have served the Guiles for decades, the last two waited with Promarchos Guile, carefully scanning the crowds who gave them wide berth. Tyr took a deep breath and started moving. How good was she at using this cloak? If she did it wrong, this was going to be the shortest infiltration in history. Tucking her fears into a pocket, she strode confidently. She drafted her bubble of peril mist around her. Maybe it would help. Someone jostled her, stepping into the seemingly empty space in the crowds where she was walking. Her peril bubble broke apart silently, but she simply formed it again and kept moving. Andros went inside, one black guard in front of him, one right on his heels. The last two, Presser and Essel, nodded at each other, then Presser slipped inside, while the light guards stood around, shifting, not even professional enough to stand still when at rest. Tyr didn't mind. It meant they took up more room and gave her more space to move. The petite, curvy Essel would wait 2 seconds, scanning the crowd once more, then come in and shut the door immediately. Tyr pressed herself against the closed side of the gate and slipped through the crack right in front of the woman. Andros Guile was supposed to wait for his security detail to reform, but he was halfway to the house. A young blackguard with a shaven head, Asif, stood at the front door with the Guile guards. He perked up at the sight of his compatriots. Standing guard all day with house guards who don't welcome your oversight of them was not a favourite posting for a blackguard, especially when one had to do it alone. Then Tyr got lucky. Andros Guile went inside and his slave, Grin Woody, stepped outside, blocking the door.
The High Lord bids you to head to the back barracks, there to await his pleasure.
The back? Asif said. But from there we can't even see who comes through the gates, much less who's in the house.
The light guards will cover the front. You will remain in the back barracks until you are called, or you will be dismissed,
Grin Woody said.
We might as well be dismissed if you aren't going to let us do our job, Essel said. I can rest at home better than—
Dismissed from the Black Guard, Grinwoody said. The Promarchos has spoken.
A smug smile lit his wizened features. No wonder people hated him. The Black Guards couldn't believe it, but in that moment of grumbling and curses under their breath, Tyr saw a gap open, and she slipped behind Grinwoody and into the house. For some reason, it wasn't until Tyr was in Andros Guile's very rooms, following the sound of his voice and the footsteps of his chamber slaves, that she realized just how frightening her new power was. She'd been scared by murder sharp, but for all sorts of reasons. Tyr herself, had infiltrated the home of the richest, most powerful man in the Seven Satrapies. She had walked into the house of the Promarchos himself without so much as an advance plan. She could now kill him, unseen, even if other people were in the very room, and without any more than a suspicion of foul play. A man his age, under the stresses of war, dying suddenly? It would elicit comment, but no more. There wouldn't even be marks on his body. Which, she hadn't realized until this moment, made her scary. It made her a predator. The thought more startled her than filled her with awe or even gratification. I'm scary. I'm scary? I am scary. Somehow, before, the notion of being invisible had meant to her that she could hide really well. It didn't mean that. It meant that she could strike from shadows. No, not even the shadows. She could strike from anywhere and simply disappear. She could kill and be at almost no risk of being killed. Murder Sharp hadn't precisely shown her how to kill with Parol yet, but she had seen him do it once, and she wasn't stupid. He'd taught her how to pinch nerves, how to move Parol through solid flesh. All you had to do was make as many little crystals of Parol as you could and let them go to the brain, or the heart, or the lungs. It might take tier 5 crystals or 10, rather than a practiced assassin's single try, but what did it matter if you were invisible, and no one would notice your failures? Andros was being attended by 3 attractive female room slaves of about 30 years of age. They took his tunic and gave him a sponge bath with quick, practiced motions, wasting no effort and not getting his trousers wet. He was flabby over a powerful frame, sweaty from a mere brisk walk, a fact he obviously noticed with displeasure. Tia guessed that was why he had walked tonight. He was trying to recapture the vigour of his younger years. And vigour it must have been, for he had the scars of a warrior drafter on his torso and arms. With her eyes downcast, the edge of the hood just high enough to let her see the women's legs, and to therefore guess when they would move, Tia slipped past them and took a place in a nook on the far side of his bed, well out of the way of any traffic she could imagine. In a couple minutes, the room slaves had him dressed again in a dinner jacket, his hair anointed with aromatic oils.
"You have something to say, Delia?"
Andros said, bored. A pause, and then a rush of words. Clearly Andros wasn't patient at drawing forth reports from his slaves.
"It's the young Lord Simon, sir. He's terribly free with his hands. One of the younger girls slipped away from him. He fell while chasing her. He shouted that he'd broke a rib and she'd pay with her life. She's been weeping since. She almost tried to run away."
"Not interested,"
he hesitated.
"The girl's name?"
"Lily."
"The blonde, the kitchen girl?"
"The same, my lord."
17 years old now?"
"Thereabouts. Slave girl, so no telling, my lord."
"The others he bothered? All blonde, all pretty? Short? What does he prefer?"
The slave Delia chewed her lip, thinking.
"Pretty, yes, my lord, though Overseer Grinwoody makes sure all the girls who serve upstairs are. Not much preference otherwise, far as I can see, my lord."
Grinwoody came in the room. Andros motioned for his room slaves, who'd been waiting silently, to leave. But as Delia got to the door, he said,
"Delia, right side or left?"
She turned, blinking, then understood.
"The ribs on his right side, my lord. A bruise, not a break."
She clearly wished it had been worse. Andros said,
"Tell Lily and the others it won't happen again."
For one moment, Tia thought perhaps this man wasn't so bad. Surely the treatment of those in his care is a good test of a man. Then he said,
"I'll not have weeping slaves in this house."
The room slave bobbed and disappeared. Grinwoody extended a tray with a crystal glass full of amber liquid to Andros Gyle.
"The vile one awaits in the red parlour, my lord."
Andros grinned.
"Never liked our toothy guest, have you, Grinwoody?"
He sipped the liquor. His mouth twisted.
"This is that Varan Mor?"
"My lord."
"You're certain it's coming into vogue?"
"My lord,"
Grinwoody said. It was, again, affirmation.
"Hmm. That which is powerful and distasteful does have its place, doesn't it?"
Grinwoody said,
"Let us hope that hiring Sharp does not come into similar vogue."
Andros laughed aloud, and Grinwoody grinned. It was more disconcerting than seeing Andros Gyle half naked. These men were friends. There was no falsity in that laugh or that grin. They might have vastly different stations, but both liked and respected the other. Grinwoody had clearly been an instrumental part in Andros Gyle's rise.
"Any new updates about Irene Malagos?"
Andros asked.
"None."
"I still worry about that."
"Withholding reinforcements has always carried the risk of driving her to the enemy, rather than making her need us more. But sending them too early would allow her to turn on us later. Your way, she'll be allied to us forever. It's worth the gamble, my lord. We'll know by tomorrow, regardless.
You've got all in order to send her the news immediately? Good. To matters closer at hand, then. Have that whore Mistress Aurelia make sure the girl she sends tonight is blonde. 16, 17, slender.
You still wish to reward Simon? Grinwoody asked, a tiny quiver of doubt in his voice.
I don't wish to, but time is short, and knowing what he likes in the bedchamber will be one more tool in hand. If he's as charming as he thinks, once he settles in at the Chromeria, such information will be more difficult to acquire. Might as well do it now. Actually, take Simon up to my solar. Dinner can wait. Make sure he doesn't see Sharp. And wait there for him. He can cool his heels. Take some of the Baron more. For yourself. Don't give him any. I want him off balance. You may lay hands on him if necessary.
With pleasure. Grinwoody bowed and left.
Andros Gyle paused at the door. In his brocade and Abornian goat's wool and cloth of gold and murex purple, he looked a king of old. He put his hand on the doorframe, though, and bowed his head, taking a few deep breaths. Then he turned on his heel sharply and walked back into the room. He came around the bend and straight for the nook where Tia stood. Her heart jumped and she almost bolted, almost attacked. She looked to his left, but the wall was too close. She would brush against him. The only way open was up onto the bed. She jumped lightly onto the bed frame, one small foot on the side frame, one on the headboard, an arm stretched out to push off one of the bedposts, to hold herself in place. If she stepped on the bed itself, she'd leave an unmistakable dent in the blankets and mattress. It was a brilliant piece of balance, especially given how disconcerting it was to not see your own limbs. The only problem was that stretching out so far like this exposed one boot entirely on one side, and her hand and forearm on the other. But Andros was already past her, bending down to pick up something that had been placed in Tia's nook. It was a painting of his late wife, Lady Felia Gyle. The frame had been broken, and there was a tear through the middle of the canvas itself. He stood, holding it delicately. If he turned counterclockwise, toward the room rather than the wall, Tia would be face to face with him. With how much of her was exposed, he couldn't miss her. Tia tried to scoot her foot along the frame and the cover of her short cloak, but all her weight was on that foot. It wouldn't slide. Andros turned in toward the room. Disaster. But he was holding the painting up. It passed between Andros and Tia, blocking his view, the frame nearly cracking Tia's nose. He carried the painting back to his desk, and Tia, breathing once more, stepped silently back into the nook. Her heart was pounding so loud it was a marvel she wasn't shaking the entire house.
"Fee," Andros said quietly. "Forgive me for this."
He fingered the tear, where he'd obviously punched through the canvas.
"I was wrong. Like so many other times we fought. You hurt me, leaving like that. It felt like betrayal. But I'm sorry, too. I shouldn't have forbidden you the freeing this year. Oh, but my dear, if you could only have stayed to see me now. One more year. You could have held on one more year, could you not? But I wasn't myself, stuck in that room. I know. I thought my light would fade before I could do all I promised you so many years ago. I need you, my dear one. What I must do with a sword, you could do with a smile."
He traced the line of her cheek with a finger.
"I shall never find your like again."
Then he cleared his throat and composed himself. He hurried from the room as if he could leave tenderness behind. Tia didn't know why, but that unexpected gentleness made her more frightened of the Promarchos than any coldness she'd seen from him. She knew that if he found out that someone had seen him during that moment, his vengeance would be terrible. As if breaking into his house and spying on him would result in only a firm talking to. "They can only kill me once." The thought didn't make her feel any better.